Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 19, 2014, during a live teleforum conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group teleforum conference call. Today, we'll be discussing regulation of the Internet and the recently decided case, Verizon versus FCC. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We are pleased to have with us today two speakers on our call. They're going to make opening remarks each of about five or so minutes. We're going to hear first from Randolph J. May. He is president of the Free State Foundation. And then we'll hear from John Bergmeier. He's a senior staff attorney at Public Knowledge here in Washington, D.C. And then we're going to have some back and forth between the two of them. And then, as always, we will ultimately be turning to our audience for questions. So please be ready with your questions when we get to that point in the program. But before our opening statements today, I do want to bring to our audience's attention and bring you up to speed on this morning's statement by FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler on the FCC's open Internet rules. He issued his statement this morning, beginning by saying, in its Verizon versus FCC decision, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit invited the Commission to act to preserve a free and open Internet. I intend to accept that invitation by proposing rules. And he goes on to outline some things that he intends to ask of his fellow commissioners. Under the general heading of proposing new rules, he mentions the transparency rule, an effort to fulfill the no blocking goal, and an effort to fulfill the non-discrimination rule. So that's his major points under the heading of rules. But he also goes on and mentions that the commission, the FCC, will not seek judicial review of the Verizon decision. They intend to, among other things, keep Title II authority on the table and solicit public comments on issues raised by the D.C. Circuit Court of D.C. Circuit opinion. They intend to move forward to hold Internet service providers to their commitments that they've made under the Open Internet Order. And then under a very general heading, they intend to enhance competition. So I guess that's a pretty ambitious statement, but I leave that to our commenters here to characterize it as they will. But with that, Mr. May, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting the teleforum, and thanks to John for joining me. John's a friend, and I anticipate we're going to have a lively discussion here. In fact, just by virtue of happenstance, perhaps, or maybe the Federalist Society actually arranged this with Chairman Wheeler's office because of the statement that Chairman Tom Wheeler issued this morning. There's even more to talk about during the call than there would have been yesterday, because we don't have to speculate quite as much as to what's coming next. But before John and I talk about what Chairman Wheeler announced this morning, I'm just going to go back and talk briefly about what the Court of Appeals did in its mid-January decision. As Dean mentioned, this is styled, as most of you know, Verizon v. FCC. And I can start off by saying, from my perspective, the court's decision is somewhat of a mixed bag. I wasn't wholly pleased with it, but on the other hand, certainly not wholly displeased. And I suspect John and I are not going to agree on everything today, perhaps, although I don't want to foreclose that possibility. But I bet he'll agree with me that from his perspective, it probably wasn't that it was, in fact, somewhat of a mixed bag as well. But having said that, here's the nub of what the court did. It held unlawful the two FCC regulations that were at the core of the FCC's net neutrality order. And those two regulations that were held unlawful prohibited the internet service providers like Verizon, for example, of course, or Comcast, or any of the internet providers from blocking access to any lawful website. And the other key regulation prohibited the internet providers from discriminating in the provision of their access services to the detriment of the so-called edge providers, and those are content companies like Netflix or applications providers. And at the same time, the court upheld a transparency rule that was part of the overall net neutrality regime. And I can just add as a footnote, I've always actually supported the transparency rule, and certainly don't have a problem with the FCC issuing that or the court upholding that. So the reason the court held unlawful the no blocking and non-discrimination requirements was that it concluded that in essence those equated to common carrier mandates. They were for practical purposes the equivalent of common carrier regulation, and that the FCC lacked authority to impose common carrier regulations on the internet providers, and this has to do with the way the internet service providers are classified as information providers rather than telecommunications providers, which are the equivalent of common carriers before the 96 Act. So the court said the FCC can't make the internet providers into common carriers. At the same, and so from my perspective, that was the right decision and a good decision, and I've advocated for a long time. On the other side, the court held that the FCC does have authority under Section 706 of the Communications Act to in some way or another to regulate internet service providers. And of course, in some way or another, and which way or another will become very important. But it seemingly construed the FCC's Section 706 authority fairly broadly. So the question, really becomes, and was framed even before Chairman Wheeler spoke today, assuming that the FCC, in fact, wants to impose a non-discrimination requirement. And keep in mind that from the perspective, I think, of the net neutrality advocates, and we'll hear John talk about this, but the non-discrimination aspect of the net neutrality rules is probably the core of the FCC's mandate, but it also happens to be the core of traditional common carrier regulation. So it's going to be very interesting to see whether going forward the FCC is able to thread the needle, so to speak, between doing something that reaffirms its desire to prevent, quote, discrimination, close quote, on the internet, at the same time not running up against, once again, the FC not running up against what the court said was a prohibition against adopting common carriage. It's easy to sort of articulate those two the differences between, you know, the two different options, but it's not so easy to necessarily understand how you prevent discrimination or impose a non-discrimination obligation without it being common carriage. So having said that about the court's decision, let me just briefly react to what Chairman Wheeler said this morning and then turn it over to John. The first thing I'd say about Wheeler's statement is that he said he wants to keep Title II authority on the table. Title II authority, if we lapse into that lingo, that's just another way of saying the common carrier provisions in the Communications Act. The FCC had issued a proceeding, had begun a proceeding back during the time it was considering the net neutrality rules to consider whether, in anticipation of this very problem that the FCC ran up against at the D.C. Circuit, to consider whether it should reclassify the internet providers as common carriers, and because if it did that, then presumably that it, and if it could do it legally, that would take care of the principal objection of the D.C. Circuit to what the FCC had done. From my perspective, it's very problematic for the FCC to keep open this Title II proceeding, because the reality is that Title II regulation just comes with so much baggage that's in the Communications Act. It includes not only this non-discrimination provision that's at its core, but the rate regulation, things like getting permission to build new facilities or discontinue building facilities. You need authority to discontinue service. There are various accounting regulations and a whole raft of these types of things. These were the types of requirements that applied to traditional common carriers, like, for example, the Bell companies back in the era when the Bell companies had a monopoly and, you know, still to electric utilities in one way or another today, or railroads back in 1887 when the Interstate Commerce Act was adopted. So that's a problem. So what Wheeler said he wants to do, in addition to keeping that on the table, is to open a new proceeding to examine the commission's authority under 706, which the court affirmed exist to some extent or another, and to see whether a new rule can be fashioned, which in Wheeler's view achieves the same objective as the original rule. Again, that's not as harmful necessarily as keeping the threat of Title II regulation on the table, but nevertheless, from my perspective, what I think the FCC ought to do at bottom is just say that it's actually going to just watch the marketplace. We could call that a watchful waiting posture, and keep its Section 706 authority open, but not do anything now, because there's nothing in Wheeler's statement, and I think most people agree there's nothing in the real world today that really indicates there's a market failure in this internet service marketplace, or that consumers are being harmed. To the contrary, and I won't belabor it right here, but I think, you know, in our own personal experiences, but putting aside those, when experts look at what's happening in the broadband world, there's pretty steady progress being made in terms of new services, new innovations, consumers being satisfied, and you know, there are always people that wish that prices were lower. That's human nature. There are always people that wish, you know, they might have some particular service they don't have. But on the whole, I think consumers are satisfied with internet service. So I don't think there's a need to do anything further now other than engage in watchful waiting. So with that, I'm going to yield, turn it over to John, and then hopefully we'll be able to engage in a little back and forth. John?
Yeah.
It's yours.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the decision back in January of the D.C. Court of Appeals was, you know, was sort of interesting, and I would agree that it's a mixed bag. I mean, I would say notably, you know, it gave the FCC a pretty significant win, not just in the fact that it upheld the FCC's rather sweeping interpretation of Section 706, basically, you know, and that's just an application of Chevron deference. And just on that issue, just let me point out that, you know, when you have a statute that's ambiguous and then you have an agency, when it's a poorly, in some respects, it's a sort of vague and poorly drafted statute. I mean, ultimately, the blame has to fall on Congress for, you know, not making itself clear, because, you know, the Chevron doctrine basically says when you have these statutes that are either deliberately or not deliberately ambiguous, we just leave it to the agency to interpret what the reasonable interpretation is. And in this case, you know, the D.C. Circuit took a look at this statute and saw that it was ambiguous, which it definitely is in a respect, and, you know, and just decided to give the FCC deference. It has nothing to do with whether it's, you know, the best possible interpretation of the statute or what have you. But anyway, you know, going on from that, though, the court also said that the FCC had established the case that it needs as an administrative agency, that the net neutrality rules were needed to accomplish the goals that it said that were needed, and that it met its evidentiary standard that it would have to meet. So basically, all across the board, it would seem a win for the FCC, except it runs into this one provision, which basically says that you cannot regulate a carrier as a common carrier except to the extent it's engaged in, you know, in common carriage activities. So, you know, so what does that mean? You know, the common carrier is really just one of those doctrines which is sort of vague, and I think it's a little bit fuzzy at the edges, because it's a common law doctrine. It goes back centuries, not just to the telephone company or railroads or the telegraph, but even earlier, you know, it goes back to the Middle Ages and inns and wharfs and so on, and it's developed over the years, and it's only been partially codified in statute, and courts have looked at it now and again and issued somewhat helpful, somewhat not helpful guidance. So, you know, in this case, the D.C. Circuit, in this case and in a previous case on data roaming, which I'll mention, has basically tried to, you know, define what common carriage is and isn't, and basically said, you know, you can't do this because this is common carriage. You know, so on that other case, the data roaming case, the FCC has said to wireless carriers that they have an obligation to basically talk to each other and be reasonable with each other, and that's not quite common carriage, but that the net neutrality rules are common carriage because they say it amounts to an obligation to carry all internet traffic and sort of eliminates your ability to do individualized negotiations. So, you know, this notion of common carriage, you know, you could write a treatise on it, because and it's just really one of the most hilarious parts of the communication law, in that, you know, basically a common carrier is defined by statute as, you know, an entity engaging in common carriage, which, you know, as I think you can see, is not particularly a helpful definition. So, you know, moving on to Wheeler's statement today, though, you know, we've disagreed with it. We think that reclassification would just be a clearer path for the FCC to do what it wants to do and provide a lot more certainty. Randy is right about the fact that Title II does have some baggage, which is basically inapplicable to broadband, but also the FCC has a tool called forbearance, where it can choose to selectively not apply parts of Title II to otherwise Title II carriers. So we think that gives it the flexibility, you know, it would need to sort of, you know, not engage in the price regulation. In terms of the Title II proceeding still being on the table, I mean, that to me, it's an important sign, because, you know, we and, you know, a few of my colleagues at other organizations are slightly critical of this approach, but at the same time, you know, it's sort of, we view it as an insurance policy. But even so, I mean, the proceeding being open is really more of a political statement than anything, because I think I'm not sure if the commissioners, if this is actually in the statement or not. No, this was in Chairman Wheeler's statement. But, you know, Title II is part of the Communications Act, and really nothing would stop a future FCC from reclassifying broadband providers as Title II if a future FCC wanted to. And, you know, whether or not the current FCC opens or closes a proceeding has no bearing on that. You know, there's been two recent cases involving Fox and the FCC. One of them on indecency, I was against the FCC. One of them on just the question of, you know, what is the standard of evidence that an agency needs to meet in order to change its mind. I was on the FCC side, and the FCC won on that one. Basically, you know, the FCC is able to change course, and it just has to meet the usual APA standard of reasonableness, not some heightened super standard where you have to, like, double explain why you think something is a good policy. And also in the Brand X case, you know, lest we forget, that was the case that where the FCC initially went down its path of saying that broadband providers are not telecommunications providers. That case, again, was not about really the wisdom of the FCC decision or its correctness, but just about the fact that this is an ambiguous question and it's up to the FCC to make the decision. So, you know, under the Brand X precedent, the FCC has the ability to change its mind, which is heightened, you know, by the recent Fox case. So, you know, well, you know, I think it remains to be seen what the chairman is going to do. One thing that, I mean, he announced his 706 plan. We think it's interesting, but, you know, I think there's still a lot of question marks about it. My biggest concern is that basically Section 706 gives the FCC the authority to do nearly everything with regard to broadband, except for the one thing that I really want. You know, the one thing I really want is really a non-discrimination rule, which, okay, maybe now under the D.C. Circuit's jurisprudence is a common carrier protection. Sure, there's a bunch of other things I think that the FCC could usefully and productively do with 706, such as removing various barriers to broadband deployment. But, you know, I'm always going to be concerned. I'm not a big fan of FCC indecency regulation. I certainly don't want a future FCC to say, oh, well, we've decided that the best way to promote broadband build-out would be to make sure that the Internet is a safe place for kids. Therefore, you know, yada, yada, yada. I think that would be pretty dangerous. So, you know, so 706 is sort of a mixed bag in that it does give the FCC some positive authority to do what I want to do, but also, you know, there's currently no clear boundaries on the FCC's discretion. In the last resort, maybe the Constitution will provide that with regard to the indecency stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I've just said a whole bunch, so I think I'm going to pause now and see if Randy has anything to react to or the moderator, Dean.
Well, let me react a bit, and, you know, we just to further refine the issues, and I thank John for what he said. And towards the end, he said something key that I think was consistent with what I predicted. He said, from his perspective, the non-discrimination rule or prohibition, you know, was really important and key, and that it's maybe difficult, or it's not so easy to see how the FCC is going to revive that consistent with the court's ruling. And you know, I would, when John was talking about common carriage and the fact that it's kind of fuzzy, there's, you know, a lot of truth in what he said, and also the fact that it goes back to the Middle Ages and so forth, which has always been interesting to me. But the fact of the matter is that, and I don't think John would disagree with this, and this is where he came back to it, the non-discrimination obligation, you know, has always been, you know, really at the core of it, and that's why I've always thought that net neutrality rules were problematical. Now, let's take it, you know, I think it would be useful to sort of go from the legal question here and the aspect of, you know, why does this matter? What's important about it? Or why does John care about the non-discrimination, you know, obligation as a matter of policy? And by the same token, why do I care about it? And And the my concern, you know, is really this, and you know, I want to say this very clearly. When you talk, you know, when you talk about non-discrimination, and sort of people listening, if they don't pay attention to what we're really talking about, then you might have two strikes against you, you know, right off the bat, because people think of discrimination in other contexts, whether it's racial or whatever, and say, "Whoa, you know, non-discrimination, bad." But what we're talking about here really are marketplaces and how the market works and the way that economists think about this type of prohibition. And so a lot of economists, I think the really the majority of economists that have written about the net neutrality rule, they have problems with the non-discrimination rule, because what it can in essence do is prohibit differentiation of services that might prove useful to consumers or responsive to consumer demands, ultimately be more efficient in terms of paying for the cost of the network. And I know one thing John and I would agree on is that it costs billions of dollars. I think in Wheeler's statement today, he said that since 2009 there's been $250 billion invested by the internet providers in their networks. And the problem that I have with the non-discrimination rule, and ultimately it could depend, conceitedly on how the FCC ultimately interprets it. But the problem I have is that at least if you don't tie it closely to a market failure and a demonstration there's been some consumer harm, that it prevents the ISPs from experimenting with their offerings again in ways that might be beneficial. So what does that really mean? And as John knows, the real what most people think is at stake in this net neutrality debate, you know, is not the desire of the ISPs to block access to, you know, various consumer sites. But hey, as an aside, I would say, you know, I think there's even they have a First Amendment right to do that, and you know, there's a constitutional issue here, and it's one that the Federalist Society probably has people that are interested in. But maybe we can reserve that for another debate. But on the policy matter and the economics of it, a lot of people, for example, to take a current example, don't realize that on any given night, Netflix is responsible for about one third of the traffic on the internet, and combined with Google, including YouTube, those two firms are responsible for about 50% of the traffic on the internet. Now, it's at least under some interpretations of net neutrality, including those that have been offered by FCC officials, it would violate net neutrality if there were ways for those companies to pay the internet providers to, you know, through various mechanisms we could talk about to help defray the cost of their networks. And because ultimately, this is key, ultimately the networks are, unless the government's going to do it, and I don't think that's what anyone wants to talk about, the networks are going to have to be paid for one way or another by the users of the networks, the consumers or the edge providers that use those networks. And it just may be that this net neutrality prohibition, if it's reinstituted, will prevent internet providers from finding ways that would be consistent with consumer desires from adopting other types of practices that allow the edge providers to contribute to support the cost of the network. And in fact, there have been plans that have been, you know, that have been suggested along those lines. So as a practical matter, you know, that's what we're talking about. I think the final thing I'll say, and then I'll turn it back over to John, is that it's we shouldn't lose sight of the fact there was an important dissent in the D.C. Circuit's opinion by Judge Silberman, specifically on the point of the FCC's Section 706 authority. And all I'll really say about it right now is that in his view, that authority is not nearly as broad as the majority construed it. He also said it's not that it doesn't exist at all. But that in order for the commission to exercise that authority, a finding of market failure should be a condition for the exercise of that authority, and that's close to the position that I've tried to articulate. So with that, John, I'm going to turn it back to you for a statement, and then maybe we'll see whether there are any questions from the listeners.
Yeah, so I'll just make a couple policy points, and then I have just one little legal point that I missed on my first go-around, and then, yeah, some questions I think will probably be good. Ultimately, I think that the reason why you need non-discrimination in ISPs just really boils down to the lack of choice that most people have in terms of their last-mile provider. They have one or maybe two choices of broadband provider. Very often, it's a high-speed, like cable provider or fiber, and then a lower-speed, you know, more value option, which just comes about just due to the nature, you know, the history of how the network were built. I think there really are, you know, I'll stand up for this, I think there are natural monopoly characteristics with wired residential broadband access. I hold out hope that one day wireless will be a suitable competitor, and that will be great, but we're not there yet, so I don't really want to make my policy decisions based on that hope. I think right now wireless is a complementary service, so it's really the lack of choice where if there's going to be one service available or two services, you know, I think that they need to be held to a higher standard in terms of what people can access than otherwise. But if there were more choice, if it were the dial-up days where you had multiple competitive ISPs that, by the way, took advantage of a different telecommunications non-discriminatory network, which was the telephone network, you know, I'd be perfectly fine with having, you know, the Christian ISP that filtered out naughty content for those people who wanted it. You know, but if that's going to be the only choice, that's where I get worried about. Yeah, I think the First Amendment issue, I mean, it's strange. No one ever argued, and AT&T didn't argue in 100 years of regulation that it violated its First Amendment rights to have to connect you to whoever you called. I don't think that common carriage, you know, whether or not you think it's a good policy or it can be applied to ISPs, you know, I think that common carriage does not violate the First Amendment, because ultimately by saying that you're a common carrier, you're saying that you're not the speaker who's relevant, you're a conduit for other people's
They're not common carriers. That's the point. I don't disagree that the First Amendment analysis, John, may be different if they're common carriers, but you're sort of, you know, I think going off in the wrong direction, because I'm arguing unless the commission reclassified the ISPs as common carriers, a substantial First Amendment issue. So that's my point. And I'll just say this to make it clear, because I know that you have a different perspective, and then you can come back. But to me, it's just odd that, and again, I'm talking about the fact that they're not common carriers. It's the First Amendment, you know, is there to protect private parties from government control or dictation of their speech, prohibition of their speech, or a requirement that they say something that they may not wish to say. It's not there to enable the purpose of it, again, absent putting aside the common carriage. It's really not there to enable the government to take actions that it thinks are just going to further speech generally. And so in this case, I think there is a First Amendment issue. But the reality is the ISPs don't seem to want to have the freedom to block websites, as I think they might have. So, you know, I don't think in the real world it's, you know, that we've got much of an issue.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't think that most ISPs, you know, I've said this before, I don't think most of them are really interested in blocking access to political content they find objectionable. You know, there have been some arguable cases in the past. I think it is possible that you could have, for example, a gripe site like a ComcastSucks.com where someone in Comcast decides that it's a trademark violate, you know, so I think you could have examples of blocking. But I would say that while I'm concerned about blocking, you know, also the court in the D.C. in the opinion last month did say that just a prohibition on blocking, not on anti-discrimination, actually could be consistent with the law in the first, and they didn't address First Amendment issues. So it's possible that a blocking requirement without the discrimination requirement, which is really about, you know, differential access for different internet services as opposed to access to, you know, political content via websites, could come back. I want to point out just two things before going to questions. One is what net neutrality is and isn't. Net neutrality is about discrimination on the last mile. So in the classic, you know, scenario, you have a last mile ISP, and it gets internet traffic that its customers are asking for, incidentally, via a backbone provider. So it would be a company like Cogent or Level 3. And these sorts of companies traditionally would carry a whole grab bag of different websites and content and services really all at the same time. So those two companies, Comcast and Level 3 or Cogent and Verizon, would come to some kind of deal to exchange traffic with each other. And what the concern was with net neutrality, and which remains the concern with net neutrality, is once the traffic has been sort of taken from the ISP, the last mile ISP tries to find a way to then to go back upstream and differentially charge different websites or different services for access to consumers. So it's really not about the physical networks interconnecting with each other, but sort of looking into the traffic that's already on your network and trying to find the source or origin of that traffic and try to discriminate on that basis. Right now, what happens when you have internet services that get so big, so it's true of Google, it's true of Facebook, and it's true now of Netflix, is they just sort of build their own network and they just directly pass off traffic to the last mile ISP. You know, either they're so big that they're such a proportion of the backbone's traffic that effectively they're one and the same, or they just build out their own network. Net neutrality doesn't say that when you're coming to agreements about connecting networks to each other that there can't be different levels of service, that you have to treat everyone exactly the same. You know, maybe there's ways that last mile ISPs could anti-competitively leverage their access to customers in ways that I wouldn't be happy with, but I would still distinguish that from net neutrality. And I don't think that when it comes to the initial concern that there's much differentiation that really needs to happen. A lot of times the differentiation that these services need to really perform effectively comes about through actual physical changes to the network. So, you know, if a company wants to spend money to improve its network and build out its servers and its content farm and its and so forth closer to where customers are physically located to improve the performance, that's not really unfair discrimination because that's an actual investment that makes the network more efficient. I'm worried about really the artificial scarcity and the artificial discrimination. That's what I find more problematic. And then finally, just the legal point. There's been a lot of talk at the FCC and in policy circles about a case-by-case approach to non-discrimination. I don't really have a problem with case-by-case adjudications as a general matter, but I just have to point out that, you know, addressing, say, an instance of discrimination case by case never works like de novo, where you know, whoever's adjudicating the dispute just looks at it as if it's like a totally new thing under the sun without any respect, without respect to any precedent. So in a real normal case-by-case adjudication, you would have discrimination and then say it's found to be unreasonable, then that would serve as effectively a rule for future behavior. I mean, that's exactly how the common law system works, is by building up precedent and building up rules that you know, that provide certainty going forward. The problem is that given the specific statutory prohibition that the D.C. Circuit cited, in which now the FCC is not going to appeal, so, you know, it's effectively that's the interpretation that the FCC has decided to abide by, you know, I'd worry that, well, even if the FCC somehow retained some latent authority to address an individual act of discrimination that it thought was anti-competitive and bad, it wouldn't be able to really ever build up a rule against similar behavior in the future because the statute prohibits it. So it would be an odd kind of case-by-case adjudication where there's less precedential value. So, you know, with that, you know, I think there's probably plenty of opportunity for questions.
All right, let's open the floor.
Yeah,
let's open it to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts or both of them, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few people on the call. Just one question at this point, so our lines will be open shortly as soon as we clear this first question. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's examine the constitutional issues in a little more depth. I find no authority in the Constitution for the government to regulate communications in any way, except under the 14th Amendment to prevent states from doing so. So if the FCC is to play a role, the only role I can see is to serve as a neutral advisor to private parties in their civil litigation. Do you see any signs of this line of argument being made in any of these proceedings?
Dean, let me take the first crack at that, and maybe John will agree. I mean, I think the constitutional authority for the FCC to do some regulation over communications companies is under the Commerce Clause. I mean, if you look at the Communications Act, you know, it's about 300 pages or more of of law. I mean, most of it is, justified under the commerce power, and I think so. I wouldn't really go nearly as far as your question implies, but that doesn't mean, of course, that you then can ignore other parts of the Constitution which may come into play, such as the First Amendment free speech clause, or, for example, in other contexts, the Fifth Amendment's due process clause. Those may become relevant. So that's the way I would answer your question.
Yeah, so this is John. I mean, I've certainly seen in other areas where there's things that the federal government is doing which, to me, are quite a stretch under the Commerce Clause. I think this does fit the commerce power. And, in fact, some of the FCC's regulations over time have been about trying to distinguish the distinction, figure out what the distinction is between purely intrastate and then interstate communications, and that's why there's sometimes a division of labor between states and the federal government. And in fact, you know, it's actually very hard to figure out what the distinction is, and that actually has led to problems, including regulatory arbitrage, where there's different rates depending on how you categorize a particular telephone call, for instance. But, you know, nevertheless, I think, you know, I have to agree with Randy on that one. I think that there are plenty of constitutional protections for all parties, including, you know, due process and the First Amendment when appropriate on the FCC, but its basic power to act is under the Commerce Clause.
Well, if I may follow through on that.
Go ahead, John. We don't have a follow-up question yet, so go right ahead.
Yeah, on our website, I have documented a great deal of evidence as to what the word commerce originally meant as of 1787. And there's a very especially clear definition of it in an article in the very first edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which makes it clear that commerce only included tangible articles of trade. It did not include services, it did not include communications, it did not include anything but the actual tangible commodities in trade. And in fact, it didn't even include articles of traded if it was traded directly from a producer to a consumer. There had to be a merchant in between. So if we go back to the original understanding, then most of what Congress is doing under the Commerce Clause is unconstitutional.
Well, John, this is Randy, and I understand what you're saying, and I, you know, appreciate the insight. If someone wants to litigate that point in the specific context of, much of what the FCC is doing, I'd say be my guest. I don't necessarily think that the chances of prevailing are good, but I understand what you're saying. I don't think we can, I doubt if we can do much to further that right here. I was going to ask Dean, if there's another question, we should take it. If not, then I may just take the liberty of posing one to John, but tell us whether there's another question.
Yeah, we've got one question pending at this point, so we will get to this next question. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the next question, let me announce that tomorrow we're going to have a litigation update teleforum on lawsuits filed against Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae shareholders filed by attorney Chuck Cooper. But today, of course, we're talking to Randy May and John Bergmeier about the Verizon versus FCC case. We've got two questions pending now, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Lynn Stanton at TR Daily. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah, we can hear you fine. Go right ahead.
Thanks. I was wondering what you thought about the indication in the chairman's statement today that he wanted to look at preempting state laws that restrict cities and towns from investing in or partnering in, or somewhere even more severe than that, having some role in a local network, and in particular, whether it seems as though 706 is an express enough kind of grant of authority with respect to that kind of interference between states and cities, which I understand has a particular, in court precedent, a particular threshold, if you will. Thank you.
Lynn, this is Randy, and thank you for that question. I just perused his statement quickly. I know he said something about the wanting to further perhaps the ability of city and towns to offer services. I don't know whether he has in mind. I don't think he said specifically preemption, so I'm not exactly sure, what he has in mind. But perhaps he's talking about preemption. But be that as it may, my own view is that that might be somewhat problematical to do if he believes that the FCC may be able to actually preempt state or municipal prohibitions against government-owned broadband systems. And the reason is, to go back to the Constitution, the states are sovereign entities, too, in our federal system. This goes exactly back to what we were talking about earlier. There are certain things that the federal government can't do with respect to the states, in their sovereign capacities. And now the states can basically, control what the municipalities do. Most municipalities, of course, are creatures of the state. So I don't know that, number one, I don't know whether that's what he has in mind, or two, that he would be able, the FCC would be able to do that as a legal matter. And I would just add, as number three, I don't think it's a good idea. I tell you what I'd like to see, just as a footnote, this, because I mentioned Google earlier in terms of the amount of capacity used by Google users. Google, you know, has begun to build out its own systems in some municipalities. It's picked out three or four to date. It's got a lot of money in the bank, for which I'm happy for Google. I'd be perfectly pleased to see Google go around in a number of different cities and start building out its own systems.
Well, I mean, let me just say, I mean, there is news on that. They've announced another 9 or 10 cities today that they have plans to
build
out to.
Well, good. Good for Google. I'm happy.
So, you know, let me just say on that point, you know, when you have these cities that, for whatever reason, decide that their current service is inadequate and they decide to take it into their own hands, I really don't have a problem with that. I think it can make sense. You know, if the local community decides to make the decision to, say, publicly fund its own broadband network, I think that's the local community's decision to make. And if you're someone who thinks it is a mistake, it's their mistake to make. I mean, I think I do believe in the principle of local control. And looking past, you know, the particular details of the federal system that Randy was just mentioning, this is an issue where if they do end up deciding, because I think it's very preliminary at this point, they're exploring their options, but if they do decide to preempt state government prohibitions on local communities deciding to build broadband, this is an issue of preemption, not used to further the notion of central federal control, but it's preemption that actually promotes the ideals of subsidiarity and local control. And I think that is a sort of it's a very interesting dynamic for that reason. Just when it comes to the Google point, I think it's great. I still do think that local broadband service does not lend itself by its nature to really robust facilities-based competition where you have multiple overlapping networks, you know, perpetually in life or death competition with each other and, you know, and the kinds that you might see in other markets. But I think there is a great opportunity for Google, for private companies of all kinds. A company that I'm very much a fan of in California is called Sonic.net, that's doing some fiber deployments itself, where you know, if technology has moved on, but the local company, the local monopolist or the local whatever is complacent and is choosing to, you know, just collect rents instead of investing and trying to serve its customers, I think that does create an opportunity for someone to come in and basically, you know, take their, you know, drink their milkshake. I think that could be great for consumers, and I welcome it. I don't think that necessarily means that the broadband economy is naturally going to always be very competitive, because it could be that the first person to build fiber, then they're in the catbird seat. But nevertheless, whatever it takes to get people faster broadband, I'm pretty agnostic, whether it's private investment, whether it's outside companies, whether it's incumbents or just local communities, you know, deciding to fund it themselves, I'm okay with it.
Well, gentlemen, we might have touched a nerve here. We've got three questions pending and about 6 or 7 minutes left, so let's go to the next caller.
Hi, it's Andy Schlafly with Eagle Forum. And the telephone network developed so well because there was a good match between the use of the service and who paid for the service. Every additional call incurred an additional cost to the person making the call. But those of us who support free market economics might be unhappy with the way the internet is today, because people can soak up all this traffic and you can even get spammers and bots and so on, and they're not paying for their traffic. So there's a mismatch in the internet today between the people who use the service and how much of the service they use and what they're paying for. It seems to me us free market people should support a migration of the internet to a model where people are actually paying for what they use, and we'll get a much more productive internet that way. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, so I think you've actually raised two points. One is you know, there's this persistent meme of the free rider. I think everyone who uses the internet pays their ISP to deliver their traffic to interconnection points. The question is whether you then have to pay every other ISP that carries your traffic or just your ISP. So that is really, I think that it, that is the primary sort of debate at the heart of a lot of net neutrality, whether, you know, Google has to build its own network, pay its ISPs, or whether it has to also pay the residential ISP, which is, you know, if the consumer is the one who is paying for their broadband connection and they are asking for Google traffic, you know, that your local residential ISP is being paid. It is being paid by the customer, the residential customer who is asking for the traffic. But there is the other related issue of usage-based pricing, where, you know, heavy users of the internet pay more, where everyone doesn't just have a flat rate plan, but different people pay different amounts. As a very general matter, think there's nothing wrong with price discrimination, with tiering, and even in principle, we have said that you could have a usage-based pricing system, which is fair to consumers. I'm skeptical of most of the ones I've seen because they seem rather arbitrary and set at weird low rates and really not connected with costs. And instead of being aimed at promoting price discrimination, they seem to have more competitive aims. But, you know, that said, I think there's just two issues. I think people can and do pay for the internet traffic that they consume already.
You know, and I'll try and make this quick. I have a problem in the sense that John said in principle he's not against some of these usage-based schemes and different types of pricing methods, but you know, I think in reality I just never see, you know, any novel type of price offering that's suggested, which he seems to agree with. So I wish the gap between the principle and the reality were not so great. And I'm just going to give this one quick example and try and make this quick. And the AT&T has a plan called Data, sponsored data, in which it wants to allow companies like ESPN, you know, maybe Netflix would be another, companies where users spend a lot of time streaming data on their. Now, AT&T's plan is for wireless devices, and they're not, wireless is not strictly covered by net neutrality, but AT&T conceivably can do this sponsored data plan. It wants to defray the usage cost from and shift it from the user to the edge provider like an ESPN. Well, when AT&T suggested that plan, which seems from a consumer's point of view to be a good thing since it wouldn't bump up against its cap so quickly, John's organization, and perhaps John, quickly said that was very problematical as a net neutrality type violation. Now, I think they recognized it wasn't strictly a violation because of the exemption for wireless, but they don't like that type of plan. So it really gets to be really problematical. And the other thing that when John talks about the difference between the principal and seeing a plan he likes, he says he's not sure that they're cost-based. They may not be cost-based. Well, the problem with that, if you want to convert these providers into common carriers and have a rate case, public utility-type rate case, like I used to participate in back in the 1970s and 1980s, full-blown, then, you know, be my guess, but that's, believe me, not a formula if you're going to be conducting those types of rate cases that are going to satisfy John, you know, that the costs are being covered in the right way. Those types of things are not conducive, really, to the dynamics of the modern day internet and the way that these consumers react so quickly and cost shift and so forth.
Well, I know that at least one of our panelists needs to go at 2 o'clock, so I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be the final word. We're at 1:59 by my clock here. I'm afraid if we take another call, we'll go long. So I want to offer my thanks, of course, today to John Bergmeier and to Randy May for their participation today. We might need to have you back sooner rather than later, given the fact that we've got a couple questions left hanging. To our audience, of course, I want to remind you And invite you to join our call tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll be getting a litigation update on the GSE cases. But until then, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.